A student of mine, Elizabeth Parkhurst, who's an artist, graduate student at State, was making mummy shrines. She cast little mummies in ceramic and plaster, and she's done beautiful installations with them. Anyway, she gave me two of these mummies, and I decided to make my own mummy shrine, and naturally I wanted to put sound into it. So I took a cigar box, and I decorated it with Egyptian Xeroxes of Egyptian art that I colored in, and the two mummies that she gave me are in there, and there's a little circuit that has a digitally sampled sound in an EEPROM, in a memory chip, so that when you open it, it triggers it off, and it kind of makes a mummy moan.
There you go.
There you go. That's a mummy shrine.
Hi, Paul de Marinas.
I had electrical switches and... Well, you want me to talk louder?
A little louder,
I'll talk
think.
Right here into the cassette
okay,
recorder.
Good.
I had... My parents would buy me, like, switches and light sockets and things like that. Well, they had the idea that I could play with them. They were good toys for a kid, and they could always incorporate them into the house. They were kind of, you know, do it. You put them in the fix-it stuff. So all of my childhood toys are kind of gone, you know.
I wish
they're
somewhere had that up
somewhere
for
in some house. And anyway,
yeah.
So I always my pad always looked like this. It always looked like this with all the wires and projects stretched around. I mean, when I was 8 years old, it looked
uh-huh.
exactly like this.
Uh-huh.
And consequently, there was never a time. I mean, a lot of the electronics I did was, you know, imaginative or conceptual, you know. Like the first video piece I ever tried doing when I was 8, I had read about brain waves, you know. And I thought that if you could hook electrodes to somebody's head and put that into the television set, that you could see what they were thinking. And so I read a book, you know, a regular adult book on electrodes, and had to make silver electrodes. So I got dimes, and I pounded them down, and I filed them, and I got my father to help me solder wires onto them. And he brought me some silver chloride from the lab. I made electrode paste. And I put it on my friend, I had this friend Dave, and I put it on the temples of his head, and I hooked it into the inputs, the antenna inputs of the TV. And I didn't see anything. I knew I'd had to tune to a blank channel because the signal of a, you know, a TV station would be too strong. And, you know, I tuned it around. It was this big old, you know, Dumont TV set with
we
a
had
little
Dumont
tube.
TV,
yeah, right.
1951.
Yeah. This is probably an earlier model than that. Because we'd had it, my parents had it from before I was born, you know, it's like an ancient one. Anyway, I didn't see anything, so I figured it needed more boost, you know, but I didn't know the difference between, you know, voltage gain and, like, voltage offset. So the only thing I had, I didn't have an amplifier, I had a spark coil, which is one of the things used in a, you know, like an old Model T Ford to give 10,000
mm-hmm.
volt spark
mm-hmm.
to this, you know, ignite the gasoline to the spark plug. And so I hooked my friend Dave and the spark coil and the input of the TV all up in series, and I turned everything on, and it blew out the tuner end of the TV, and a kid got, you know, well, I mean, he got a, you know, big shock. I mean, he jumped and ran home, and I got in some
trouble.
But it was like all that fantasy stuff, all the things that you don't know, you know, you're allowed to play. People aren't telling you. You can't do this, or this won't work, or this is science and this
uh-huh.
is art or anything. So consequently, playing with those toys, there was never a time when I grew up later, you know, when you hit 13 or something, when you're no longer interested in the toys of childhood, because they were perfectly acceptable
mm-hmm.
adult toys. So I just kind of kept going.
They sure are.
And sometimes I just sit in the floor here with a pile of wires, and I'm in whatever that nameless fantasy is that I was in when I was 8 years old, and I think that's... You know, all your feeling is connected around that thing. So electricity has really that connection for me. So the high-tech thing, it isn't because it's high-tech. In another 20 years, electricity will be low-tech. But I think my involvement with it will still have that same spirit because I have some, you know, connection with it.
Whether you're kind of delightfully modest about it. I mean, you also use computers and synthesizers, and I mean, you probably use the first synthesizer that ever happened.
Yeah, but so does
sure.
everybody now.
Yeah.
Everybody uses computers and synthesizers
except
this year.
Except for me.
Well, but you do, I mean.
I feel very bereft, but I'm going to keep on in my old-fashioned way. How do lasers work, and what are you doing with them?
Well, I don't know if I want to get into a discussion with my limited knowledge of physics on how lasers really work.
Well, how are you using them?
That's
what I really meant.
Quality of laser light that I use lasers for is its coherence and its it's the fact that all this light sticks together for so long. You know, it's all the waves are in step, and it doesn't diverge out. The beam stays, can be focused down very fine, because what I'm doing is I play records with lasers.
78s or
78s, 45s, 33s. And my interest in doing that stems from a fascination with the vinyl object. Now that the vinyl object, this record, which we played for so many decades, only from the beginning to the end. That's the only way anybody ever would deal with that object. I mean, Atali has a beautiful section on the effect of the of the wax of the vinyl recording on music, the ownership of music. And
who's Atali?
This is the most important book about music that's, in my opinion, that's ever been written. Jacques Attali, he's an economist. The book is called Noise, The Political Economy of Music.
Okay,
and it's the only book about music that I've ever read that was interesting. And
well,
it's written by a non-musician, naturally. It's
check
written by
it
a
out.
Non-musician, a Marxist economist.
Is this a Bruegel on the back?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Very noisy painting.
Well, noisy. I mean, look over here. Here are the upper class of the town coming out of church. Lent has already begun for them, right? And they're being very pious and quiet, and they're obviously annoyed that Carnival, Mardi Gras, is still going on among the lower classes. And he extends that metaphor, the idea that noise is violence. Noise is murder. And the power to make noise is the political power. How noise is organized into music represents, or in his opinion, presages how violence is channeled by society into the state.
I had a roommate who basically was annoyed at me, really annoyed at me, and he really used to torture me with noise, because he would fall asleep with the TV going off the air, and it would be white noise, and I'd hear this white noise for hours and hours and hours and hours, and it was definitely sonic torture.
For him.
For me.
For you.
He didn't hear it, and I felt so persecuted by this white noise, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But to get back to Atali, you were saying the piece of vinyl that we've lived with for so long, we listen to it in sequence from beginning to end, and then what?
Well, this thing you buy, this this record, is a commodity. You know, it's an object that you buy. But in order for it to have any value, you have to also contribute your time.
Yes.
To listening to it.
Yes.
Now, I knew in the 60s, I met a guy who loved great music, he said, but he didn't have much time with his hectic schedule to listen to it. So he'd put on, in the morning, he was getting ready for work, he'd put on a stack of, like, the Beethoven symphonies on 78 RPM. These are 33 RPM records. And he'd just play through them that much faster. He'd get, you know, by the time he was brushing his teeth, the Eroica would be on. You know, by the time he was ready, the end of the Ode
That's
to Joy
great.
was playing away. You know?
How fast would it go?
Well, it goes about, you know, 2.5 times faster. So he didn't get through all the Beethoven symphonies, but I mean, it's.
And is the sound all distorted? Is it different?
Well, it just sounds like the chipmunks.
Yeah, like the chipmunks. Yeah.
But I mean,
fabulous story.
Yeah. I met another person about a year later who had, you know, had access to tape recorders and had condensed Beethoven's Ninth Symphony down to a 4-second sound by taking the tape of the symphony and cutting it in half and mixing it two channels together and then repeating the process of cutting in half and mixing it until it got this 4-second sound that was just gorgeous sound.
Do you have it?
No.
Have you done anything like it?
Anyway, well, I get close to that sound.
With these?
By playing the records with lasers, I can defocus the beam. And by introducing spatial filters, which are just very fine reticular patterns, I can select certain frequencies or certain times in the record. And so I can kind of give the feeling of the music when it's going through your head, that it's, you're in a cloud, you know. Sometimes you're, when music runs through your head, you're like really right there on the money with it. But a lot of times you're just kind of in this cloud where you go backwards mm-hmm. a few bars and forwards mm-hmm. a few bars, and you're just kind of in this place. Well, I can do that. I can also do all those cut and paste effects, all mm-hmm. those postmodern clipboard mm-hmm. things that we all know and love.
I loved listening to these to these cuts. This is, I've always loved you and Stepping Long Trail with the Maestro.
Yeah, Patterns of Wear, yeah.
Because I know the piece, or I've heard, you know, I
Yeah, well, everybody's
pieces,
heard
so
those.
It's so much
yeah.
fun.
Yeah,
What's the surface noise? Like just the 78?
Yeah, it's the noise of the optical noise of the vinyl. I mean, or Bakelite in this case. It's not it's, you know, I'm depending on the specular reflections of this very mm-hmm. rough surface. So it's all the noise that's there. It's the noise of that object. And you can think of the record, in a sense, as some kind of, it's a three-dimensional object, and you can think of it as a kind of hologram of the music. It's all there at once, and it's only this convention that we have, that we play only one sound at a time, and we believe that it's that piece is only that piece, which is something that music gave up so many, 40 years ago, that idea died in composers' minds, mm-hmm. but in listening to records, it still goes from the beginning to the end. I think the attempts to make records that play differently, Richard Heyman was the only person I've ever known who made a record. He cut that record with crisscrossed grooves that would play different uh-huh. every time, but it would also kind of wear its own habits, uh-huh. the way it played on your machine, uh-huh. so it would become an object of repetition, customized to the ballistics of your recorder.
Seems that you have this curious dichotomy. I mean, I see it as such. You probably won't agree, because you're not agreeing with anything that I'm saying, but that's fine.
Well,
but that that.
If I agreed with you, you wouldn't be asking me questions.
That's right, and it wouldn't be very interesting. But you have this, this is how I see it, that this, you like going back to some kind of cave person mentality, or Neanderthal, way back with the technique, with technological things to produce objects.
Well, when
you
say
I mean?
Cave and Neanderthal, I get scared, Barbara, because of that song of yours with the big penises on the ends of the sticks.
I didn't
and
mean it that way
I don't
at all.
I'm not
in that mode now. No, I'm thinking we're in the campfire, or we're at the beginning of music.
We're always at the beginning.
I love it.
We're all
I
only
like
at
that.
The beginning.
Good, good.
If we're not at the beginning, then we're at a very sorry place. We're at an end. I mean, in the sense, this era is the end. You know, when you talk about high tech, but computers are the end of...
Are they?
They're the final sick fruit of the 18th century. You know, the 18th century wanted to organize everything.
They did.
And
the rationalists and
yeah.
the machine age. Yeah.
And in direct contrast came the 19th century, which wanted wild abandon, the unconscious mind.
Rousseau.
Nature, Darwin, you know, mm-hmm. that nature has its own set of rules that is not very nice and it's not rationalistic mm-hmm. and it doesn't fit into cubby holes and taxonomies and, you know, Freud and you know, the political revolutions of 1848, you know, the idea that they had, it was really wild abandonment list, you know, the Wagner, you know, this great emotional thing. And here's what I think. I think the 20th century is not an original century in the way that the 18th and 19th centuries were. I think we're a conciliatory century. We're trying to reconcile the order and the wild abandon of these two previous centuries. And we're like the child of two arguing parents.
But this is the Western society you're talking about, which is kind of at the end.
Well,
right?
It's all one society.
I think it's all
one
society.
One now. Yeah, yeah. It really is. World society is. That's shrunk. Part of the reconciliation. Yeah. Hmm.
So then, if we're at the end, are we also at the beginning?
I don't think.
We're coming
yeah.
To a
well,
beginning,
I'm
or
saying.
Are we
I mean,
really
you're
coming
always,
to
you're
an
always
end.
Coming to ends of certain things, and the stuff that you call high tech.
I keep thinking of end too.
I think is the end of an old of one way of thinking. You know.
I mean, I'm all right with my watercolor and my brushes and my little pan of water and my piano.
Yeah, I don't know if you're happy. I guess
I don't
you are.
Know. I am
I mean,
really
you're,
happy.
You're rich enough in this society to, if you're happy, and nobody's going to come and take them away from you. I mean, the police protect you from anybody who would, as long as you pay your taxes, the police protect you from anybody who would want to take say that, you know, you can't do those things.
I'm happy, but I feel archaic in a society. What, you know, that's why I'm feeling defensive about high tech and everything, because everyone does computers and things like that, and
yeah, well,
I feel very dumb or something, you know.
Well,
we
they're just
be,
18th
we
century.
They're 18th
On contrary,
century?
I think we should be talking about you.
Well, I don't. We could talk about me another time. How do you see yourself in older age?
In older age?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have no idea. What do you mean? When I get old? When I get older than I am now?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I see you similar. Just maybe your hair a little grayer or something. But how do you see yourself?
Oh, you mean visually?
No, I mean.
Probably look like my father.
And what will you be doing, do you think? Do you
oh,
have any
I don't know.
Idea?
I kind of. I'm always interested in things, and I'm always trying new things. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing of using lasers, I'm just beginning.
I love that
and,
idea.
And I love light. I've really grown to love the quality that intangible but so convincing quality that light has.
I've never seen any of your installations at Exploratorium and so on. Do you use light in those installations?
No, those are sound.
Those are sound?
Sound, yeah.
What do you see as a utopian society, if it were ideal, if it were possible?
Well, I don't think that any one solution to two different problems is anything other than another problem. I think there are many, many problems in many societies, you know. There are many, many kinds of problems, and that one answer is something that's very, very far away from utopianism. I mean, I think the perfect utopianism is, you know, maybe Nazism or something. It was somebody's utopia.
Mm-hmm.
It was somebody thought that was the answer for everybody, right? That's the utopia.
What would be utopia to you? If you had a perfect world that you existed in with your family and friends and music and whatever, what would
well,
be
Well,
I like?
Think there's just about the right amount of tension in this world, don't you?
Yeah. I just would like a little more money for airline tickets, but that's about it right now.
Yeah.
And
I think,
don't like
well,
the threat of total extinction
but those are specific issues. I mean, we can deal with those. Those are things that in our world we can deal with. We may feel extremely powerless sometimes, but they are human. They're social things. They're things that have to do with other people. Money, nuclear extinction, those have to do with the spirit that we share with you and I
yes.
and all the other people.
Yes.
We're all people. It's not like you know, volcanoes or disease.
No,
that
but
we
do
can't.
We have any control?
I think whenever, and it's not control, but we share the same spirit with everybody else. And I don't think that, I think things are possible when the problem is one brought about by other people. That, you know, I mean, we all share, we all communicate.
Do you think that the artist and musician have a role in
Absolutely. I think what we have to do is get people to see, because for the first time in any society, we're of very low value. This is like the first time that the artists are not valued. The other day, I was at the Exploratorium, and a man from another nameless science institution, a very famous and revered science institution.
In the United States?
In the United States. He said, your music room at the Exploratorium, it's a piece I did as an artist in residence there in 1981, 82, which is a system with touch-sensitive guitars that anybody can go in and jam together, and the computer takes care of the intelligence of keeping everybody together, and people can just play
and
interact.
The music?
Yeah, I developed that back 6 years ago. Anyway, he said, this is such a fantastic, successful piece. We want this for our museum. And I was going through, you know, well, if you wanted it, you know, the money thing, no problem, money. You know, the copyright, retaining the copyright to the software and all that, which I want to retain, no problem. And then I said, and also I just like to have my name, that I developed this as an artist in residence at the Exploratorium, and my name on it. He said, oh, no, we can't get that by. It doesn't fit our format. And I said, well, wait a minute, what do you mean it doesn't fit your format? I mean, this is... And I started to realize that what these institutions want children to think, there are going to be tens of thousands of children going in and seeing this and loving it, and they're going to be led to think that this is something made by a committee, by an institution,
not by an artist. Person,
and when they go and vote, they're going to vote for committees and institutions and bureaucracies. They're not going to vote that dollar for the arts. They're not going to vote a penny for the arts.
And then they won't think that they're capable individually.
And they won't think that,
that happened to me until I was about 35. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And that's the thing.
Yeah.
That's
exactly. You want, I mean, it isn't my ego gratification. It's to know that
someone else,
that this is an artist, that somebody did something.
Person.
And this, if this is the thing you enjoy, then you might enjoy doing that. I think our society is full of little formats like that, little traps that hide the contributions of artists and musicians and poets at all points.
That's very distressing.
And it's part of our corporate society, and I think that's something that we can and must fight.
How?
Well, I can sell them the piece or not.
And will they get it? Will they buy it?
If they,
they're going to come through?
If they want it, I want that.
Of course.
I want it to acknowledge me as an artist or an artist. I'd use a fake name if it said artist. And I want the Exploratorium to get credit too, because they're the only place that sticks their neck out on artists and gives artists funding to create unrealized pieces, you know, pieces that haven't been made yet. Everybody wants something once it's proven, you know. But very few places. So you spend your whole life making copies of something, you know.
That's when you have to have a philosophy and decide you won't. You can't.
Well,
you have to do.
Well, it's a way to make a living sometimes.
Thing, I guess.
Sometimes it's just like having a job, you know. To make another of a piece, it's okay. I don't see anything wrong with that. But
so the responsibility is to be pretty rigorous and stay true to yourself and not do imitation pieces.
I don't know if that, I wouldn't use
money.
The word rigorous at all. Rigorous sounds like rigor mortis.
Oh, I see. Well, I meant strength, some kind of strength of will.
Strength,
not
yeah.
to give in
well,
to
corporate.
Well, it's
the kind of strength, that, you know, that it's the strength of rope rather than the strength of you know, it's that kind of floppy strength.
Well, thread. Look
thread,
how
yeah.
look at thread. I wrote a poem once that said, "Thread is so fine and everything, but it does keep all the clothing together for a long, long, long time, and it's very fine and it doesn't seem that strong."
Yeah, it's a different kind of strength. The word rigorous is used. The two words that I detest most
are rigorous.
Rigorous.
Oh God, and I used
and,
it.
Well. And excellence, which is the word that the TV stations always use when they're talking about Exxon Corporation supporting some symphony orchestra
or cheese whiz like or something.
Yeah, excellence, which is a euphemism for mediocrity, which means halfway up the mountain. Medium acris, right?
Maybe what?
It means halfway up the mountain.
And what was
medium acris. Acris like Acropolis, Acra.
Oh, mountain. I haven't heard that. So if you were giving advice to young artists or composers, what would you tell them?
Here's how I do it. I fall flat on my face. I do pieces. I always like to keep my pieces a certain failure element in them, that the subtle art of disappointment. So that people think, shit, I could do better than that. In a way that encourages them to go out and do it. To go out and do that.
That's exactly.
Because those are the things that inspired
right.
me.
Oh, that's wonderful. Me too.
Those are the things that I
me
thought,
too.
Well, I like this, but I could do this, you know?
Me too. Berio for Linghetti. And of course, then I found out, well, maybe you can and maybe you can't, Barbara. It's not that easy. But they did. And Hundert Wasser, he's a visual artist. But that's exactly.
Yeah. I think that's the folk music aspect of what I do. That it isn't folk in the sense of, you know, everybody singing this song, but no song could be that song in this day and age, because the you know, pop music industry would have to decide to press a million records of it and push it to the radio stations, you know? But what it is it gives people that folk idea that they could do it themselves, and encourages people to do the music.
Listening to your music the last 24 hours, I didn't think I could do it myself necessarily, but I did get the folk, folk in quotation marks, idea with Coccolet and what else? I Want You, especially Beneath the Numbered Sky, which we're going to hear all these
ethnic,
songs.
Yeah, those
I really
ethnic roots.
Did like them a lot. They were very beautiful. They just about made me cry. You probably don't like that aspect.
No, I do.
But
they make
me
cry too.
I
think
was
crying
very moved.
is one of the things
lot.
That I looked at when I was young. I looked at paintings. I lived in Italy for a while, and I would go to look at all those famous Renaissance paintings, you know, and none of them ever moved me to tears.
No.
Whereas I could listen to you know, a record of a Tchaikovsky symphony or something, and I'd cry, and it moved me to tears. The music still has that quality for me, that it moves me in that way, and I think that's very special. It used to be only a certain kind of music moved me to tears, but now just about anything does.
What about having a child?
What about having a child? Did that move me to tears?
No,
that's entertained me. Tremendously. Uh-huh. My son is such an amazing, I mean, it's like, you know, having a child for me is like, you know, some discovery, something that I wouldn't normally have done. It wasn't like I didn't have an agenda for it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a script for what it was supposed to be. And so it's just been a wonderful discovery. Like when you decide, oh, well, yeah, I think I'm not going to go to work today. I'm going to like go to the Grand Canyon and like pack on a mule or something, you know, you wouldn't have thought, you know, like you knew what it wasn't something that I thought I knew all about. And so that was really, that's been a wonder for me. Just a wonder.
What about when you laid eyes on him the first second?
Looked like a motorcycle wreck. I mean, you know, no, I mean, it's all visceral.
I,
and, you know,
I wept when
blood,
I saw
you know.
My child for the first
time. See, I was there for the delivery.
I just wept, you know.
I was there for the delivery. And so it looked like viscera, and, you know. I
guts.
Mean, it just looked like guts to me, you know.
What's your favorite piece that you've done of your own?
Gosh. Probably I Want You. These days, I think I Want You is the...
Uh-huh.
Is my favorite.
Which we're going to hear as well. I like I Want You too. What composers do you enjoy right now? Composers that are living?
Gosh.
Or friends?
Yeah. Well, I really like Brenda Hutchinson's music a lot. I think Brenda is one of the most amazing composers. I like John Bischoff's music a lot.
I like his music too.
Again, both of those are very full of feeling, with, you know, no particular attention to what media they use or anything. Whatever they touch. I don't know, not to leave anybody out, but those are two who come to mind. Oh, Linda Fisher. Linda Fisher is a new composer in New York. Linda Fisher does some of the really most beautiful and full of feeling, challenging, strong, but very full of feeling music that I've heard. I can see if I can get you a tape.
Okay, I have to write that down. Just when I hear a new...
Letitia de Compiègne, I think is absolutely wonderful composer. That's interesting. Three of them are women. Two of the four people that I can think of whose music I really love are women these days.
What's the last thing you think about before you drift off to sleep?
Usually, I don't know, it depends. This week worries.
Because
I guess I'm getting ready for this show.
Yeah.
Right, it's different. It's different all the time.
Same when you wake up, just different stuff.
Yeah, different things. Mostly worries this week, you know, panic and all of that stuff.
Of course. What about dreams? Do you have a recurring dream?
Oh, gosh. I think dreams are all kinds of things. And, you know, sometimes they're simple wish fulfillment. Sometimes they're you know, very profound things that have nothing to do with us as individuals. And
but
all
I just
those
meant
things.
As a story These days, or a
no.
picture.
These days, no. I haven't had any what I consider, like, important dreams.
Mm-hmm.
For a couple of years, I had a whole series of dreams about toxic-skinned lizards.
Toxic-skinned lizards.
Yeah, lizards with poisonous skin, yeah.
How pleasant for you.
Well, no, very powerful creatures. Uh-huh. Very, very, you know, unconscious, strong creatures. The untamable, unconscious kind of thing. I kind of, you know, I pay special attention to those dreams that go in series for a few weeks, you know, and other things. I mean, you know, I have dreams about my personal life, or I have dreams that are just, you know, fantasy dreams or something like that.